content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated May 26, 2025. The front cover, as usual, is bordered in bright red with a narrow white inner border. Time, in large block capital lettering, is superimposed upon a dull, almost cranberry or mulberry purple. And the lettering for Time is in a gradient lighter than that background. The photo image, the portrait on the cover, is an American Pope, Leo XIV. A pleasant-looking face smiling at the camera, wearing glasses, white hair, short cropped. Not much on the top of his head, but that is almost covered by his white cap. He's wearing the vestments of his office, white cassock with lace trim on the sleeves, covered by the purple capelet, and a stole in very heavy gold embroidery upon another dull purple color. He wears a gold ring, and it is Pope Leo XIV. The first two articles that I'm going to read are very long, so I will be abridging them seriously. Trump's first 100 days under the heading Nation, the president speaks on amassing power, confronting the courts, and upending the world America made, by Eric Portalesa, with additional reporting from Alex Altman, Massimo Calabresi, Sam Jacobs, Nick Popley, Washington, D.C., and Leslie Dickstein and Simone Shaw, New York. Again, I'm abridging this. President Donald Trump emerges through a pair of handsome wooden doors on the third floor of the White House. On his way down the wide carpeted staircase, he passes portraits of his predecessors. Nixon is opposite the landing outside the residence. Two flights down, he has swapped the placement of Clinton and Lincoln, moving a massive painting of the latter into the main entrance hall of the mansion. "Lincoln is Lincoln in all fairness," he explains, "and I gave Clinton a good space, but it is the portrait around the corner that Trump wants to show off. It is a giant painting of a photograph. That photograph, the famous image of Trump, fist raised, blood trickling down his face, after the attempt on his life last July at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. It hangs across the foyer from a portrait of Obama in tacit competition. When they bring tours in, everyone wants to look at this one," Trump says, gesturing to the painting of himself in technicolor defiance. 100 to 1, they prefer that," he says. "It is incredible." Making his way out to the Rose Garden, he walks up the inclined colonnade toward the Oval Office, describing the other alterations to the decor, both inside and out. His imprint on his workspace is apparent. The molding and mantles have gold accents now, and he's filled the walls with portraits of other presidents in gilded frames. He's hung an early copy of the Declaration of Independence behind a set of blue curtains. the box with a red button that allows Trump to summon Diet Cokes is back on the Resolute desk, behind which stands a new battalion of flags, including one for the U.S. Space Force, the military branch he established, a map of the Gulf of America, as Trump has rechristened the Gulf of Mexico, was propped on a stand nearby. If Trump is making cosmetic changes to the White House, his effect on the presidency goes much deeper. The first 100 days of his second term have been among the most destabilizing in American history. A blitz of power grabs, strategic shifts, and direct attacks that have left opponents, global counterparts, and even many supporters stunned. Trump has launched a battery of orders and memorandums that have hobbled entire government agencies and departments. He's threatened to take Greenland by force, seize control of the Panama Canal, annex Canada. Weaponizing his control of the Justice Department, he's ordered investigations of political enemies. He has gutted much of the civil service, removing more than 100,000 federal workers. He's gone to war with institutions across American life, universities, media outlets, law firms, museums. He pardoned or gave a commutation to every single defendant charged in connection with the January 6 attacks, including those convicted of violent acts and seditious conspiracy. Seeking to remake the global economy, he triggered a trade war by unleashing a sweeping array of tariffs that sent markets plummeting. Embarking on his promised program of mass deportation, he has mobilized agencies across government, from the IRS to the Postal Service, as part of the effort to find, detain, and expel immigrants. He has shipped some of them to foreign countries without due process, citing a wartime provision from the 18th century. His administration has snatched foreign students off the streets and stripped their visas for engaging in speech he dislikes. He's threatened to send Americans to a notorious prison in El Salvador. Says one senior administration official, "Our success depends on his ability to shock you." What shocks constitutional scholars and civil libertarians is the power Trump is attempting to amass and the impunity with which he's wielding it. Trump has claimed Congress's constitutional authority over spending and foreign trade, citing a loosely defined emergency. He has asserted control over independent agencies and ignored post-Watergate rules designed to prevent political meddling in law enforcement and investigations. When lower courts have ordered him to slow or reverse potentially illegal moves, he has at times ignored or publicly ridiculed them. In one case, he defied a Supreme Court order, issuing a ruling in that fight. Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, a Reagan appointee and arguably the most influential conservative jurist outside the high court, said the administration's behavior threatens to reduce the rule of law to lawlessness and tarnish the very values for which Americans of diverse views and persuasions have always stood. Trump is not the first president who has expanded presidential power. Franklin Roosevelt summoned wartime authorities to institute rationing and price controls, forcibly incarcerated 120,000 Japanese Americans in internment camps, and tried to pack the Supreme Court with ideologically aligned judges. George W. Bush restructured the national security apparatus after September 11, handing the government extraordinary powers to surveil everyday Americans and detain al-Qaeda suspects at extrajudicial black sites abroad. Both those presidents were dealing with attacks on the U.S. Trump's second-term presidency is unlike anything his predecessors attempted. Trump's approach to power looks like that of foreign leaders like Viktor Orban of Hungary and Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, argues Stephen Levitsky, a Harvard University scholar. These strong men have won legitimate elections, then stacked the democratic decks in their favor by rewarding allies, punishing adversaries, crippling the media and civil society, turning the state into an instrument of their political preservation. This is actually much faster, much more thoroughgoing than what we saw the first 100 days in Venezuela or Turkey or Hungary, he tells Time. What worries me most has been how slow U.S. society has responded. Some institutions are fighting back. Law firms Perkins Coie and Wilmer Hale won restraining orders from a federal judge. Harvard University refused to acquiesce. After Trump tried to shut down the U.S. Agency for Global Media, as well as the media outlets it oversees, including Voice of America and Radio Liberty, several brought suits to stay afloat. The Supreme Court has already intervened in several cases, but their capacity to constrain Trump is limited if he defies their orders. The courts cannot save us alone, says Levitsky. The judicial process is slow, and a lot can get broken in the meantime. Opponents have howled about the threat Trump poses to the Republic for long enough that for many it's easy to dismiss the talk of constitutional crisis. Yet the president himself stokes fears of a slippery slope to strongman rule with his blanket assertions of power, his disregard for democratic guardrails, his talk of running for a third term, despite the 22nd Amendment's prohibition. There are some loopholes that have been discussed, Trump says, but I don't believe in loopholes. Toward the end of the interview, Time asks Trump whether he agrees with John Adams, a founder whose portrait he has framed in gold on his wall, who said the American Republic was a government of laws, not of men. The president pauses to think it through. I would not agree with it 100%, he says. We are a government where men are involved in the process of law, and ideally you are going to have honest men like me. Once the tape recorder stops rolling, Trump offers a tour through his private spaces beyond the Oval. Framed copies of magazines with his face on the cover line the walls. He passes into the dining room, where he watched and did nothing as the January 6 attack unfolded. A gold remote control and two boxes of Tic Tacs sit on the table. On the threshold above the door hangs the boxing belt that Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky left behind after their contentious meeting in late February. He leads his guests into his study, which aides have dubbed the Merch Room. There are two white break fronts filled with MAGA memorabilia, hats of different colors and varieties, gold Trump brand sneakers, white Trump golf shirts, Trump coffee table books, towels with his Trump 4547 logo on them, and challenge coins featuring the Trump family crest inside the seal of the President of the United States. It may not be the traditional image of American presidential power, but it is his. Again, that lengthy article was abridged, as will be this one, Next Level, fresh off an NCAA championship, number one draft pick, Paige Beckers, B-U-E-C-K-E-R-S, it could be Bukers, I'm going to say Beckers, adds to the WNBA's momentum by Sean Gregory. In early April, 3 days after winning a national title for the University of Connecticut Huskies, and closing out one of the most decorated careers in college basketball history, Paige Beckers is chilling out in a dressing room at The Tonight Show, where she is scheduled to make a cameo with the championship trophy. Host Jimmy Fallon pops by, assuring her this is the first of many appearances. Captain Kirk Douglas, guitarist for house band The Roots, offers his congratulations as Becker saunters down the hallway in her college jersey and shorts to tape a bit. "This is the last time I'll ever wear the UConn uniform," she says, not entirely ruefully. She then puts on a rhinestone-adorned flannel shirt and baggy camo pants and appears on the stage to screams of approval. Becker's, and here the text says, pronounced Becker's, is beaming when she returns backstage, having climbed the stairs through the audience, letting a lucky few tap the hefty hardware. "It was a little workout," she says, "more than I've had the last couple of days." As much as any sports star on earth, Becker's 23, has earned her break from the athletic grind. The past few days have been a whirlwind, a celebration in a Tampa hotel after UConn's walloping of South Carolina, the 2024 defending champions, in the title game, then back in Storrs, Connecticut, for a homecoming rally, followed by a Mary J. Blige concert in Hartford. Becker's Fallon stop is one of a number of appearances in New York City, after which she will make a quick trip back to Storrs for a parade and then return to New York to officially become a pro. Her selection by the Dallas Wings as the first overall pick will surprise no one, but come with another round of fanfare. Nike threw her a draft night celebration, where some 150 of her friends and family danced late into the night. "It was there," she tells me at a New York City restaurant a few days later, "that it sank in. The UConn chapter of her career is over. This has been one of the greatest 2 weeks of my life in terms of happiness and joy, but also I'll just be sitting in my room and start crying," says Becker's. "It is tears of happiness. You're so extremely grateful that it even happened, but you're obviously sad that it's ending." After going 10 days without touching a basketball, Becker's would have to ramp up her workouts in preparation for the WNBA campaign. Paige is going to have to make the adjustment. The speed of the game, the rules of the game, the physicality is all different. The veterans are not going to take it easy on the rookie. Paige is going to feel her rookie moment at some point. She will have to navigate the comparisons to the adjustment that Caitlin had. "We're all mindful and aware, but we're going to be very supportive that this is Paige's journey and no one else's journey." Becker's takes those comparisons in stride. "That's what the media cares about," she says. "That's what everybody who watches basketball cares about. I used to be bothered by it, but I've done so much work on myself and my approach. The ability to not run a race in comparison, to run my own race and worry about that. Caitlin's a phenomenal player. We're also completely different players. Pitting the two most recent number one draft picks against each other," Becker's admits, "is good for the game. At the end of the day, I don't think either of us really cares about it because we're just trying to be the best versions of ourselves." She's ready for the North Texas heat. "I want to give everything I have to the organization, to the city," says Becker's. "I know Dallas is a sports city. I'm walking in there wanting to be a great leader, a great teammate, wanting to be a winner at all levels, wearing that jersey and representing that city with pride and a passion and joy for the game of basketball. I want to give to that community. I want to be invested in it. We're all looking to do something special. That will all come soon enough. For Becker's, for now, clad in a national championship sweatshirt, she just wants to eat a double cheeseburger with her friends, who are waiting at a nearby table. As the sun sets on her championship celebration, she will steal a few last moments. Then, buckets will go back to work." The brief news, first a photo, it's nearly half a page, more like a third of a page, grassy green lawn in the foreground. in the mid-background some kind of a building. It looks like it's either native stone or a very dull concrete block. It includes a wall. It's got a right angle in it. A low building with a right angle into a wall. And then behind that, tall hills, or perhaps they're considered mountains. Also in the foreground, directly in the foreground, a mashed up piece of aluminum in kind of a funnel shape. And behind that, with mostly phones and cameras in their hands, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 men. Kashmir crisis onlookers taking the debris of an aircraft May 7 in Pampore in Kashmir. The majority Muslim region, India and Pakistan, have fought four wars over. The latest round began April 22, when 26 tourists were massacred in an area controlled by India, which accused Pakistan of backing the attack. India later launched airstrikes at Pakistan, which said it shot down five planes. Also on this page, the bulletin, minerals deal boosts Ukraine aid prospects, by Brian Bennett, Nick Popley, and Simon Schuster. Ukraine agreed to hand over half its future oil, gas, and mineral wealth to the U.S. in a landmark deal signed April 30. While the agreement does not offer Ukraine the explicit security guarantees it had long sought, it does, in effect, give President Donald Trump and his allies a tangible economic rationale for maintaining U.S. aid. The terms, which include Ukraine's paying for U.S. military assistance from a new resources fund, dissolved weeks of tension between the inner circles of Trump and Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky after a heated Oval Office exchange in February. Optimism. Zelensky's leadership team was buoyant about the deal. This is probably as close as we're going to get to security guarantees with this administration, a foreign policy advisor to Zelensky, who was involved in the negotiations, told Time, describing the cost to Ukraine from the deal as minimal. A former senior Ukrainian official had a more measured reaction. The Americans can tell the Russians not to attack any projects with U.S. investment, but that does not give security to the rest of the country. GOP shifts gears. Republicans have been at odds over Ukraine, with Trump-aligned lawmakers skeptical of continued involvement and national security hawks intent on countering Russia's continued invasion. But several Republicans in Congress told Time that the deal creates a path to continued support that could be sold to voters as either a business arrangement or a moral obligation or both. This puts American skin in the game, said Oklahoma Senator James Lankford. The door is now open for more aid, said Kansas Senator Roger Wicker, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Shared interest. To hold off the Russian invasion, Ukraine needs real-time intelligence from the U.S., weapons for fighter jets, and missiles for Patriot batteries defending civilians. The deal may provide a way to persuade Trump to pay for Ukraine's defense with dollars and cents. From the brief milestones page, elected Mark Carney, C-A-R-N-E-Y, Canada's leader. In a pivotal election April 28, Mark Carney's Liberal Party won a fresh mandate. The former central banker of both Canada and England beat the Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, who had been leading in the polls for more than 2 years against the deeply unpopular Liberal Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. When Trudeau stepped down earlier this year, Carney replaced him and called a snap election to cement his power. Carney positioned himself as the best candidate to contend with U.S. tariffs on Canadian imports and threats from President Donald Trump to make Canada the 51st state. In a meeting with Trump in the Oval Office May 6, Carney's message was clear. Canada is not for sale. That was written by Stephen Maher. Called up Israeli reserves for new Gaza offensive. This is by Callum Sutherland and Chantel Lee. Israel's government confirmed what many in Gaza had feared. Its military will seize the territory indefinitely, calling up tens of thousands of reserve soldiers to significantly expand operations. Israel's new plan, announced May 5, marks a turning point in the nation's war strategy, one that NGOs and human rights groups warn will only escalate the humanitarian catastrophe inside Gaza, while Israeli forces have previously advanced deep into Gaza during the war, a sustained military presence has largely been confined to a 1 kilometer buffer zone along the border. In April, that zone was expanded, denying Palestinians access to more than half the territory. The Israel Defense Forces declined Time's request for comment. Many Israeli reservists are refusing call-ups, with thousands signing letters to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calling for an end to the war. Turnout among reservists is reportedly only 60% in recent weeks, half that of October 2023. Inside Israel, families of hostages still held by Hamas have criticized the new military strategy. The Hostages and Missing Families Forum told Haaretz the government's plan prioritizes territory over lives. This decision will be remembered as a cry for generations, the group said. Odeh Bashir, who lives in Deir al-Balah in Gaza, says he continues to fear for his life. No one's coming. No one's going to stop this war, he says. The war began after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7, 2023, killing more than 1,200 people and taking some 250 hostages. In the military campaign Israel launched in response, more than 52,000 Palestinians have been killed, according to Gaza's health ministry. Israel resumed attacks in March after a nearly two-month ceasefire. And on the lower edge of the page, a small strip including four different headings, there's a small photo. He's nearly swallowed up by the bottom of the page. It's Warren Buffett, white hair, glasses, smiling, dark suit, white shirt, red and white tie. Berkshire Hathaway, CEO, Warren Buffett's intention at a May 3rd shareholder meeting to retire at the end of the year after 60 years. He recommended Vice Chairman Greg Abel, A-B-E-L, take over. Need I spell Buffett? B-U-F-F-E-T-T. Banned transgender women from women's soccer teams in England, the FA said May 1, after the UK Supreme Court ruled in April that gender is based on biological sex. Died Brazilian nun, Sister Ina Canabaro Lucas, April 30, at age 116, the oldest living person. David Souter, S-O-U-T-E-R, U.S. Supreme Court Justice, who disappointed conservatives, May 8, at 85. Published details of an anti-venom that scientists say can protect against various snake bites, thanks to antibodies in the blood of a man who endured hundreds of snake bites and venom injections. The Brief. A New Era by Aaron Baker. Pope Leo XIV will be the first American to lead the Roman Catholic Church and its 1.4 billion followers. So this is the cover story. another photograph of the Pope, this time in the same vestments as he appears on the cover of the magazine. But here he's flanked by two other individuals, garbed in purple and purple and white. And he's waving at the crowd from the balcony. The photograph is by Alessandra Benedetti. Addressing an ecstatic crowd gathered in St. Peter's Square as the newly anointed leader of the Roman Catholic Church, American Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost used the world's most famous pulpit to promote a vision that of late has been more wish than reality to all people, wherever they are. To all the people of the earth, may peace be with you, he said in fluent Italian. As Pope Leo XIV, he's now tasked with delivering it. Prevost's appearance on the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica was the culmination of a centuries-old election ritual in which selected cardinals sworn to secrecy gathered behind the closed doors of the Sistine Chapel to pick the man best suited to lead the church through a period of immense change. He succeeds Pope Francis, who died April 21, and will be expected to continue in the globally beloved leader's path toward a more open, inclusive church that advocates for the poor and the marginalized. The voting began Wednesday, May 7, with an inconclusive result. An additional three rounds were held Thursday before Cardinal Prevost obtained the required two-thirds majority. The fact that the voting took less than 2 days, on par with the selection of Pope Francis in 2013, shows that the cardinal electors were largely united in their choice of a man known for solid judgment, sharp insight, and the steady hand needed to lead the church through a tumultuous time. The papal tradition of a cardinal's taking a new name as he is announced pontiff symbolizes his rebirth as custodian of the church. The chosen name often signals the direction the new pope intends to take. By choosing Leo, that's L-E-O, Prevost was making a powerful statement. Pope Leo XIII, whose turn-of-the-century pontificate straddled a period of global upheaval, defined by the Industrial Revolution, was known for his defense of the rights of workers, his advocacy for immigrants, his care for the poor. In many ways, Pope Leo XIII was very conservative, but on social issues he was very strong. I am guessing Cardinal Prevost, that's P-R-E-V-O-S-T, wanted to signal his commitment to social justice in the tradition of Pope Francis, says Brett C. Hoover, a theology professor at Loyola Marymount University in California. Still, the fact that the new pope donned the traditional gold-embroidered sash and red cape that Francis, in a sign of his commitment to humility, refused to wear at his own anointment in 2013, signals Leo XIV plans to take a more conciliatory approach to church conventions, even as he expands on other aspects of Francis' legacy. In his short address to the faithful, Leo XIV praised Francis' commitment to outreach and inclusivity and laid out his own plans for continued dialogue and a church that always seeks peace, that always seeks charity, that always seeks to be close, especially to those who suffer. The successor's public embrace of pontifical tradition, alongside Francis' provocative agenda, balances the concerns of a church leadership split over issues of doctrinal purity. A calm and thoughtful leader, according to those who know him, this Leo XIV is a Francis with sanded down edges. Born in Chicago to a family with Italian, French, and Spanish roots, Prevost, 69, will be the first pope from the U.S. the Catholic Church has ever seen, and only the second pope from the Americas, after Francis, who was from Argentina. He attended a high school run by an Augustinian seminary, then went on to get a degree in mathematics at Philadelphia's Villanova University. He spent most of his life outside the U.S. Ordained in 1982 at the age of 27, he went on to serve as an Augustinian missionary, parish priest, and eventually bishop in Peru, where he spent more than two decades. Francis made him a cardinal in 2023. As an American with Peruvian citizenship who spent most of his career serving the world, he is uniquely poised to balance the demands of a global church against the worst impulses of an isolationist America. After addressing the crowds gathered in front of St. Peter's Basilica in flawless Italian, he thanked members of his Peruvian diocese in perfect Spanish. Notably, he did not say a word in English, thank the people of Chicago, or refer to his American origins in any way. That was deliberate, says Hoover. He was saying, I'm an American, but I'm a different kind of American. I'm not a nationalist. I'm a person that cares about the entire world. That did not stop U.S. President Donald Trump from congratulating the newly minted Pope in a social media post soon after the announcement. It is such an honor to realize he's the first American Pope, Trump wrote. What excitement. What a great honor for our country. I look forward to meeting Pope Leo XIV. It will be a very meaningful moment. Close confidants describe Prevost as reserved, almost shy, but they uniformly laud his ability to listen. In meetings, he was like a sponge, says Father Andrew Small, who has worked with Prevost on several high-level church commissions. He is a listener, and his questions tell you he is processing what you are saying. Pope Leo XIV comes to prominence at a pivotal time when principled leadership is more vital than ever. He faces ongoing conflicts in Ukraine, the Middle East, other parts of Africa and South Asia, along with the politically divisive but morally urgent issues of migration, religious freedom, human rights, and the climate crisis. He will have to navigate a surge in right-wing nationalism, as well as a potential economic slump that threatens the world's most vulnerable. The power of the papacy extends far beyond Catholicism's 1.4 billion followers. The Pope may not have the military or economic power of other leaders, but he has a moral authority that most global leaders lack. Whatever its weaknesses, the Church has always, at least over the past 150 years, given priority to people on the margins. And we need that more than ever in an era of America First and Fortress Europe, says Richard Lennon, a professor of theology at Boston College. We need someone who can speak up for the poor, the marginalized, the displaced on the world stage. Even if people just nod politely and move on, we still need that voice. With his stated commitment to build a united church, always seeking peace and justice, the new pontiff made it clear he would be that voice. The church's need for a counter to Trump's brand of America First global realignment likely played a role in Prevost's selection, says Lennon. He is the least American American. It would not surprise me at all if that was part of the thinking of the cardinals, that they wanted someone who could keep challenging attitudes and actions that disregard the value of human lives. As Leo XIV takes up the Pope's mitre, many will expect him to build on Francis' legacy. It will be a difficult undertaking. Francis' criticism of capitalism's excesses, his calls for world leaders to respond to the warming climate, his impassioned advocacy for migrants made him globally popular. Yet within the church, his reformist interpretation of church doctrine, who am I to judge? He famously responded when asked to weigh in on gay priests, set off a polarizing struggle between modernists and traditionalists. So too has his radical approach to inclusivity that welcomed the non-ordained faithful, including members of the LGBTQ+ community and lay women, to sit with bishops and contribute their thoughts on issues of church doctrine in meetings called synods. It is this vision of synodality, the church as a listening one instead of a top-down teaching one, that was at the core of Francis' progressivism and the biggest threat to traditionalists who seek stability by maintaining power and influence of church leadership. To the relief of many in St. Peter's Square, Pope Leo XIV confirmed his belief in the consultative process. We want to be a church of the synod, he said. Francis leaves behind a lot of unfinished business that the new pope will have to address. During his 12-year pontificate, Francis galvanized liberals, both Christian and secular, by breaking long-standing church shibboleths. He said divorced and remarried Catholics could take communion, and he allowed priests to bless same-sex unions. He brought up other controversial issues, such as the ordination of women as Catholic deacons, whether or not married men can become priests in regions where vocations are rare, and the use of birth control, but failed to offer a definitive take, frustrating many of his followers. Church members will pressure Leo XIV to offer clarity on these and other pressing issues facing the modern church, but how he leans is a bit of a mystery, says Lennon. As a missionary who spent most of his life outside the U.S., he was able to stay out of the culture wars that define American Catholicism. On these issues, he is the great unknown. There's a difference between the person you are the day you get elected and who you are as Pope. How he responds to these questions will either cement Francis' progressive legacy or render it as a temporary aberration. Pope Leo XIV also faces the challenges of a more practical nature, such as the Vatican's parlous financial state and its diplomatic ties. One of the hallmarks of the Francis pontificate was a groundbreaking agreement with Beijing that allowed the Chinese Communist Party leadership to weigh in on church appointments within the country. A few days after Francis' death, an interregnum known as sede vacante, the empty seat, when all leadership decisions are put on hold, Beijing unilaterally named two bishops, including one to replace a Vatican favorite. Leo XIV's response will set the tone for his approach to Beijing's increasingly overt challenges to Vatican authority, as well as its persecution of underground Catholic clergy in a country that's home to approximately 20 million Catholics. There's a photograph in the top half of this page that I'd like to read the caption for. Pope Leo XIV presided over his first Mass as Pontiff May 9. It is in the Sistine Chapel featuring all of those very colorful paintings on the walls and ceiling. The Pope is carrying his gold crucifix cross. He's vested in white and gold. He does have the papal mitre on his head. He's surrounded by cardinals, I'm quite sure, based upon their vestments, and they're all clapping as he walks down the aisle, leaving the space. But one thing that interests me here is that he's wearing black shoes, none of the fancy shoe stuff that previous popes may have worn. This appears to me, not that I'm an expert, to be a working pope. Back to the text. The Catholic Church's contentious history with sexual abuse and its coordinated efforts to cover these instances up remains an ongoing issue that Pope Leo XIV will not be able to avoid. The advocacy group Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests has criticized Prevost for not doing enough to address sexual abuse and for failing to follow up on accusations against priests under his jurisdiction. He clearly has a great sense of empathy, especially for the vast numbers of Catholics and people in general in the global South and elsewhere who live in unspeakable poverty and injustice, says Small, who was former secretary of the Pontifical Commission for Protection of Minors under Francis. But by being in touch with such massive amounts of suffering, one might unwittingly relativize the pain of a much smaller group of people in the church who are victims or survivors of sex abuse committed by its members or mismanaged by its leadership. We all have something we need to work on, and I think that's an area that needs urgent attention. Pope Leo XIV is inheriting a church in financial distress, says John Allen, a longtime Vatican analyst and editor of Crux, C-R-U-X, a Catholic magazine. Donations are down, the budget's beset by a $94 million deficit, and its pension system is grievously underfunded. The Vatican is, to be frank, a bit of a mess right now, particularly with regard to its finances. It is facing a ticking financial time bomb. For the secular world, one of Francis' most important contributions was his stance on climate change. His seminal Laudato Si encyclical, a 175-page pastoral letter on the religious importance of caring for the planet, sparked a climate movement within the church that echoed through the temples and mosques of the world's other great religions. As the inheritor of that mantle, Pope Leo XIV will be expected to maintain the Vatican's commitments on climate change while urging world leaders to do the same. The planet, our own survival, is at stake, says Father Jostrom Isaac Corridadom, professor at Rome's Salesian Pontifical University. As cardinal, Prevost was known as a passionate environmentalist. In a 2024 seminar on climate change in Rome, he reiterated the Holy See's commitment to protecting the environment and urged countries to move from words to action. Dominion over nature, the task which God gave humanity, should not become tyrannical, he said. It must be a relationship of reciprocity with the environment. Given his background in Peru, one of the world's most climate-vulnerable countries, he will likely keep carrying that banner. Francis' shadow looms large, but ultimately, Pope Leo XIV is the successor of Peter, the first pope, not Francis, the most recent one. He will make his own mark, and the faithful will follow. The rest of the world will take note. The next thing I read, which will finish out the hour, will be abridged. It's the View essay, Society, Despair and a Gun in the House, by Olivia Rockeman, R-O-C-K-E-M-A-N, who's a Brooklyn-based writer and journalist. She's working on a memoir about suicide, loss, and grief. On the morning of my dad's death, it took me 10 minutes to choose what to wear. Toast a blueberry waffle and pour chai into a thermos. It took 10 minutes to drive myself to school and choose a spot in the parking lot designated for high school seniors, a cohort that I finally belonged to. Within the next 10 minutes, I opted to leave my umbrella in my car and arrived at a calculus class with damp hair. Each of these quick decisions unfolded in the same amount of time it likely took my dad to plan and execute his suicide. In the months leading up to his death, my dad struggled with double vision and a limp doctors could not get to the bottom of. It is possible those symptoms were caused by neurological damage from 2 brain tumor surgeries he had when I was young, or from another condition like multiple sclerosis, though he never received a diagnosis. Even so, my dad's suicide was shocking, Despite his physical impairments, he worked every weekday, ran with me on the beach, advised me on my college applications. He showed no obvious signs of depression. Even the people closest to him did not know the depth of his pain because of his calm, reserved demeanor. The time between deciding to end one's life and performing self-harm is often no more than 10 minutes, according to a 2021 study of unsuccessful suicide attempts. Following whatever intrusive thought my dad had on that December morning a decade ago, it would not have taken more than 10 minutes for him to write his suicide note on the desktop computer, walk upstairs to the printer, bring it back to the office, where he would kill himself. I hate to imagine it took only a few more minutes for him to get the gun down from the top shelf of the closet, a gun I did not even know he owned, and load it. My dad was not vocal about being a gun owner. The only guns I'd ever seen him use were the BB guns we learned how to fire at father-daughter camp we visited in the San Diego mountains every fall of my elementary school years. He taught me how to aim at the tower of soda cans 50 feet away and puncture the aluminum with tiny holes. Was this enough practice for him to know how to use the gun that would kill him? Did he have to read an instruction manual, watch a YouTube video? Perhaps then the time between wanting to die and executing his suicide was far more than 10 minutes. I'll never know. What I do know is that access to a gun made my dad 8 times more likely to die by suicide, primarily because firearms are the most lethal suicide method, according to a 2020 study by researchers at Stanford University. When a gun is not available, suicide attempts are typically not fatal, and most people who attempt suicide do not go on to die in a future suicide, the researchers wrote. Owning a gun, in other words, can turn an intrusive thought into a death much faster and more effectively. It is impossible, then, not to place some of the blame for my dad's death on the gun, and to wonder if he would be alive now if he had not inherited it from his grandfather 30 years before. I'm haunted by the thought that in the split second between pulling the trigger and impact, my dad might have realized all that he would miss by leaving my mom, sister, and me, and wished to change his mind. Ken Baldwin, who survived a suicide jump off the Golden Gate Bridge when he was 28, told The New Yorker in 2003 that in midair he instantly realized everything in my life that I thought was unfixable was totally fixable, except for having just jumped. Could issues in my dad's life have been fixed if he did not have the swift way out the gun provided? He was scheduled for eye surgery to repair his double vision in just 3 weeks. And with more time, it's possible doctors would have found a solution for his limp, which was especially frustrating, given that his favorite activities were skiing and running. At a minimum, maybe he could have seen a psychiatrist who would help him realize staying alive meant watching just one more episode of Lost with me, or summiting another mountain with my grandfather, or meeting my sister's baby, his first grandson. The U.S. is home to the highest gun ownership rate in the world, and recent years have shown an uptick in gun purchases by liberal Americans and women. I understand this desire for people feeling threatened by political or police violence or crime. Still, what is often thought of as a form of self-protection is also a personal threat. Of all gun-related deaths in 2023, 58% were suicides. Painfully tragic school shootings and stories of murder dominate the gun control debate. But in America, we're often more dangerous to ourselves than others are to us. In 2022, the rate of suicides involving guns in the U.S. reached the highest level since officials began tracking it more than 50 years ago. Research shows fewer people die by suicide when it's harder to die by suicide. So-called means restriction, the modification of an environment to decrease access to suicide means, is the intervention measure with the strongest empirical support. For instance, when Britain removed carbon monoxide from its public gas supply in the 1960s and 1970s, the annual number of suicides in England and Wales showed a sudden, unexpected decline. Gas accounted for nearly half suicides in the region before the carbon monoxide removal began, and researchers found that those prevented from accessing gas did not appear to find some other way of killing themselves. Restriction of one method of suicide, in other words, did not inevitably lead to a compensating rise in the use of others. Roughly a third of Americans own guns. I can't help but wonder, if my dad was not part of that group, could his hope have been restored in 10 minutes? Perhaps our cat Romeo would have come into the office to sit on his lap. Or maybe he would have received the text messages from his best friend sent later that morning, asking how he was doing. Perhaps when I got home from high school that afternoon, I would have found my dad relaxing in his brown leather chair in the living room, rather than a squadron of police cars and yellow caution tape. Ultimately and unfortunately, the answers to those questions are unknowable to me, just as the grief his suicide would cause was unknowable to him. That last article was slightly abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.